All right. Good morning, everyone. So morning. Last time we spoke about the very famous story of Tanor Shel Achnaya, the Gemara in Bava Metzia, in which we have this dispute that takes place between Rabbi Eliezer and all of the Chachamim. Rabbi Eliezer thought that the oven had one status, but the Chachamim thought that it had this other status. And they had this back and forth argument, Rabbi Eliezer was trying to bring proofs why he was correct, and he used all these supernatural things to take place, right? He asked the walls of the Beit Midrash to cave in. He asked the carob tree to be uprooted from the ground. He asked the river to go upstream, and all these things happened. A baskul, a heavenly voice, came out and deemed that the halacha followed Rabbi Eliezer. And over again, the Chachamim kept saying, "We don't paskin like the trees. We don't paskin like the water. We don't even paskin like a heavenly voice. We only follow what our own tradition or our own minds can guide us to what the halacha is. And if the Chachamim disagree, since they are the majority over here, we follow them." And so now what we're going to do today is kind of read the second half of the story. Most people don't know the second half of the story. The second half of the story is sort of what the aftermath was and what kind of took place as a result of all of this, because you could imagine that after the Chachamim made it very clear that we don't follow the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer, so let's just understand something. Rabbi Eliezer was not just some schlub. He was a very, very big rabbi who many, many people followed and was otherwise very respected halachic decider. And so now all of a sudden, if they're going to have such an elaborate back and forth to determine that we don't follow him, well, what are you going to do in other situations that we perhaps have followed him in the past? And what is going to be of Rabbi Eliezer? Again, he's not just some Joe Schmo. He's a big rabbi, so we do want to offer him some respect. So we're going to have to see how the rabbis dealt with it. Before we do that, Walter had a question. Walter, can you...
I was fascinated with something. First of all, I was looking to the Mishnah before we got to what we're speaking about, and it says something very interesting for me. It says, excuse me, just as there is wrongdoing in buying and selling, there is also wrongdoing with words. And this is really very prophetic, and they're saying something very important. So as you said, we have this esteemed rabbi speaking. He's making sense. He's not coming out from left field. And what I'm able to pick up now in exasperation, the rabbis are saying to him, something to the effect, what you are arguing, you cannot argue with this because it was already given to you. The Torah was given to you at Sinai, the exact words. As if to say, that's it, we don't care what you're saying. But then we get to the position where we're talking about a council which is formed, and they will determine. So I think what I'm trying to say is, it's a little bit arrogant. It's a little bit arrogant for the rabbis to stifle Eliezer, because the whole gist of what we're looking at in terms of Talmud, I've always believed, I think the correct word is pilpul. It's a constant discussion back and forth which never ends. And I think if you read between the lines, we are given a lesson that maybe those who are trying to stifle Eliezer, that they're wrong.
Okay. You want to flesh that out a little bit more? Why are they wrong? Because that seems to be the opposite
way
that I would understand it.
They are wrong because they should welcome this disputant. They should not be that severe with him. He has every right to say that, and they have got to take that into consideration of their thinking.
Okay, let me push back for a second. So you are correct that Gemara is all about pilpul. It's all about this back and forth. This one says this thing, and this one says the other thing, and they agree, they argue, they whatever, and they have a back and forth conversation. But at the end of the day, you do need to find a solution at some point. Like, what do you do? You could only have theoretical, you could have theoretical conversations until the cows come home. But when the cows come home, you need to know what you're doing when it comes to, in this situation, what they were going to do with the stove, and in other situations, what you're going to do in any other area of halacha. You need to know what to do. And so you need to know, you can't just have everyone just offering different opinions. You need to have some sort of uniformity.
There must be situations when someone can, like Rabbi Eliezer, makes this pronouncement, that the rest in other situations will listen to him and incorporate that which he said in their decisions. Yes to what you're saying. You know, it's like the Supreme Court. There's the majority opinion and you have dissent all around. Yet, at some juncture, at some point, one would think, in this particular case, the way it's presented to us, the way it's couched, and it's very severe, they say, go away. That's all objective. There's a tone there.
Okay. Now, you're 100% correct, and it's going to get even worse. I'm not sure if you read ahead or not, but the what's about to happen gets much worse. And so it's a fair point. The reason why ultimately that the Chachamim had such a strong response to Rabbi Eliezer in particular is because Rabbi Eliezer, like we said, is not just a Joe Schmo. So his opinion carries a lot of weight. And the reason ultimately why they needed to, well, I don't want to give it away. I want to hear other suggestions. But there is a reason to this. And you're correct to say that they would not necessarily have been as harsh with everyone else. And one of the reasons why they were this harsh was specifically because Rabbi Eliezer was as great as he was. And they did not want to risk, therefore, anyone thinking for a moment that he could be correct. And so I think it is a perfect segue. So let's jump in. And Walter, feel free to keep pushing back, but I want to jump in and actually see the text a little bit. And if you don't like where I'm going in a little while, you'll let me know, okay? Okay, so the Gemara says further, so the sages said on that day that the sages brought all of the ritually pure items deemed pure by the ruling of Rabbi Eliezer with regard to the oven and burned them in fire, right? So it wasn't enough for the Chachamim just to say that Rabbi Eliezer was wrong, but they actually, they sent out a message to the entire community, to the entire Jewish world. If anyone here has an oven that Rabbi Eliezer had once decided was okay, well, you're wrong. It wasn't okay. And so now we have to destroy them all. So it was a giant day of koshering for the entire community. Everyone brought their ovens in, and it was you trade in your old oven, and you have to go out then and buy a new oven, because they're not giving you one for free. So you would have to go and replace your oven. And the sages reached a consensus in his regard, and they ostracized him, they excommunicated him, which is obviously very harsh. Why did they need to excommunicate Rabbi Eliezer, or why did they see fit to excommunicate him? Walter, I'm looking at you.
They ostracized him because it's even more severe than I was thinking beforehand. You know, they made a pronouncement, and that's all I could come up with now. How dare he go against what they said? I can't believe it. I'm having trouble even believing what I'm reading.
Okay, so the main reason... Also, Walter, can you turn your camera up a little bit? I just want to see your face more.
Oh, I always have that damn question.
What?
Did you see me better?
No, I see you worse.
It's worse. There's a little button on the damn thing. Oh, here we go.
There you go.
Ah, look at that.
There button. You are.
Beautiful.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
Go
ahead. All right, so when the rabbis saw fit to ostracize, to excommunicate Rabbi Akiva, it came from one specific place, and that is that while they did embrace a multiplicity of opinions, what they did not embrace is when someone at the top could potentially challenge the authority all the way at the top. Meaning that at the end of the day, you need to have someone who is communally fully accepted by everyone that will be able to offer the final psak. In the same way that the Supreme Court, right? If the Supreme Court in America would be questioned by another judge, by anyone else, it's not to say that there are not many other wonderful judges out there. It's just to say that if there all of a sudden is a renegade Supreme Court that is going to issue rulings in opposition with them, and that some people would respect and pay heed to their opinion, so that could become very problematic. And so essentially what's happening over here is that the Chachamim did not want anyone to think that as great as Rabbi Eliezer was and as high of a position of authority as he has had, that that should continue and that his opinion would be allowed to continue. And so therefore they said, okay, Rabbi Eliezer, we're going to excommunicate you. We don't want anyone to even be under the faulty assumption that your opinion should be allowed to be followed according to Halacha, because now that the issue has come to our dispute and to our faces, and we have decided in one direction, no one is allowed to disagree with that. So that's not to say that if this had not reached the level, the caliber of the Chachamim arguing, but rather there were others who perhaps, you know, might have dealt with this issue prior to that, okay, so you were allowed to follow your local Orthodox rabbi, as it were. But once it reached the highest point, the most central point of power in the rabbinic world, so no one wanted to create the illusion that they wouldn't, that they that the Chachamim should be argued with, and so that's why they excommunicated Rabbi Eliezer. Doesn't make it more palatable to read. It's still quite distressing to see that the rabbis were, it seems to be, so cruel to one another, but as we'll see in just a little bit, that they try to soften the punch a little bit. So let's keep reading a little further. And
is this comparable to Spinoza?
I don't know.
Well, he was ostracized also.
Okay. Maybe. And the sages said, who will go and inform him of his excommunication? Rabbi Akiva, his beloved disciple, said to them, I will go, lest an unseemly person go and inform him in a callous and offensive manner, and he would thereby destroy the entire world. Right, so this is a little bit of an odd statement. Right, so Rabbi Akiva tells all the rabbis, I have to go. I have to be the one to break the news to Rabbi Eliezer that he's excommunicated, that he's not allowed to be a part of our community in a sense anymore. And the reason why is because v'nimtza machriv et kol ha'olam kulo, that he might destroy the whole world. How could Rabbi Eliezer destroy the world?
I don't know.
Well,
unmute yourself for a second.
I'm thinking suicide. Because if you take one life, you...
Okay, good. So Marie says maybe he would commit suicide as a result of this. And if we know if you take one life, it's as if you destroy the entire world. Okay, could be. The only pushback that I would offer is that we likely wouldn't accuse Rabbi Akiva of accusing his Rebbe of being suicidal. Again, not that you just wouldn't assume that he would think that his Rebbe would do that. Not that, you know, you can't help it sometimes, and people are mentally ill, but that's probably not where he was going with this. Any other suggestions? What could Rabbi Eliezer have done to destroy the entire world, and why would they be concerned about that? So one additional perspective that we can offer over here is just, again, to go back to this tension that Walter was bringing out before, is that Rabbi Eliezer was not a schlub. He was a big deal. He was one of the righteous, most righteous people and greatest rabbis of his generation. And so as a general rule, we like to believe that our rabbis have a certain connection with the upper realms. And so if this rabbi would find out that he was excommunicated and be really, really annoyed at all the other rabbis, then all it takes is one word, you know, with he'll put in a word with a man on top, and he could destroy the whole world in that way. And so what Rabbi Akiva is basically concerned about is that Rabbi Eliezer would be so upset, so furious, that he would try to destroy the entire rabbinic world as a result, and that his tefillot would be focused for negative things, which they couldn't afford. Whether or not God actually actually works like that is not, you know, what we're talking about right this second. But that was Rabbi Akiva's concern, and so he said, let me go. Let me be the one to soften the punch a little bit so that we don't have to worry about him having any sort of a major pushback to this ruling. And so let's keep going. What did Rabbi Akiva do? He wore black and wrapped himself in black as an expression of mourning and pain, and sat before Rabbi Eliezer at a distance of 4 amot, which is the distance that one must maintain from an excommunicated individual. And, okay, well, let's pause for a moment. So why was Rabbi Akiva putting on this whole show? Why was he wearing black?
Mourning.
Why is he mourning?
Special mourning.
Well, why is he mourning? What do you mean? This is what the rabbis ruled. Why should he be mourning?
The loss of his... It's like he's lost...
Mourning the loss of him?
Good, right. So both June and Maurice said, right? Because even though he's still alive, in a sense, he has lost his Rebbe now because no one's allowed to interact with him anymore. And it's not just that Rabbi Akiva himself was mourning, but that he also probably wanted to demonstrate for Rabbi Eliezer, this is not easy for me, Rebbe. I am giving you this news that I never wanted to have to share, but I am doing it and sharing it with you while I'm mourning to show you how sad I am that I have to do this. I have to do it, but I'm sad that I have to do it. And Rabbi Eliezer says to him, Akiva, what is different about today from other days that you comport yourself in this manner? Why are you dressed like a goth? And Rabbi Akiva said to him, my teacher, it appears to me that your colleagues are distancing themselves from you. He employed euphemism as actually the distance Rabbi Eliezer from them, okay? Rabbi Eliezer, too, rent his garments and removed his shoes, as is the custom of an excommunicated person, and he dropped from his seat and sat upon the ground. Right, so what's most interesting about Rabbi Eliezer in this moment is his response to the rabbis excommunicating him, right? Because he really could have flipped out if he wanted to, right? Remember, this is the guy who, when he was arguing with the rabbis, he used the heavenly supernatural assistance to do so. He used as the tree and the water and all these things to get involved. And so now when Rabbi Eliezer is so upset about things, so why does he just accept it at this point?
Why didn't he accept
it? No, why did he accept it?
Why did he accept it?
Did.
Yes, did. D-I-D, yeah.
He had no other choice.
Helen, what'd you say?
He said he realized he was wrong.
Okay, so Helen says he realized he was wrong. Okay, could be. June, what did you say?
I said he probably felt like he had no other choice if they had ruled that.
Okay, yeah.
To accept it.
That's more what I'm thinking as well. It's this reality check that he had to accept what was going on. This is the world that he bought into. He did not want to break off and start a whole new sect of Judaism. This is his world. And his colleagues all said that you're done. And so he had no other recourse other than to just accept what his fate was and, you know, move forward with it. He was terribly depressed about it. He had to be in a state of mourning. Now he was sitting on the ground, but he accepted it, which is really important because, again, this story is sort of a paradigm for how to have even the most severe of arguments. And, you know, nowadays when someone doesn't like something often or when someone disagrees, they often will walk away. But more than just walk away, they'll start their own thing, right? A breakaway shul or, you know, that's what everyone likes to do. And so this is a really important lesson that Rabbi Eliezer is still teaching, even in his excommunication. And that is that, listen, if the system, for one reason or another, has decided to go in a different direction, so that doesn't mean that you should then just go ahead and, you know, start a new group. No, you accept it. And perhaps he was thinking also maybe one day he could earn his way back into the ranks of all the great rabbis, but for now he's willing to accept the ruling of the majority of Rabbanim, which is a very powerful and a very humbling reality that he was able to sort of just accept it at the end of the day. The Gemara,
so the lesson is that he is a humble individual, and there is true fidelity to those who are in power and ruling. And that's what he's communicating to his congregation at best.
Right, 100%. He was trying to demonstrate that
this is
do...
very strange.
It is strange. But he was trying to demonstrate that we do have a system and we do have an order for how we do things. And he understood very well that perhaps at the beginning of the argument, the goal of that argument was for him to prove them right. Him to prove himself right over them. But when he was not able to do that, so he said, okay, listen, I'm going to have to accept the system that I have already bought into, which says the majority rules, and that's that. Nothing else I can do. And finally, the Gemara relates, his eyes shed tears, and as a result, the entire world was afflicted. One third of its olives were afflicted, one third of its wheat, and one third of its barley. And some say that even dough kneaded in women's hands spoiled. And the sages taught there was great anger on that day, as any place that Rabbi Eliezer fixed his gaze was burned. So what's going on over here?
The world is in mourning. Everyone's in mourning.
Okay, maybe the world is in mourning. How else might you understand this?
He's causing damage.
Okay, good. All right, 100%. It's exactly what they had feared, right? They were afraid that he was going to destroy the world. So Baruch Hashem, I guess Rabbi Akiva softened the blow a little bit, but through his anger, again, what this means and how exactly this works, that's not really, it's above our pay grade to fully understand. But Rabbi Eliezer was this incredibly holy individual who was reined in a little bit by his dear students, but ultimately this is the fruition of all that they had been insecure and concerned about, that he had at least partially destroyed the world. He destroyed a third of the crops. These aren't just treats. These are basic food categories. Wheat, a third of the wheat and a third of the barley. The animals won't eat, humans won't eat. And so this was a major deal. And so ultimately we see that even though the Chachamim did feel strongly about what they did and that they had to do what they did, this had serious ramifications for them, and it shouldn't be lost on any of us just how severe this was. And
so it's to reinforce.
What do you mean?
Well, to reinforce what you've just said, what the fact that he was out of the fold, he brought this down. It reinforces what he did. It was a terrible thing. He's been excommunicated. He's in mourning. His tears are in his eyes. And to reinforce all that, this destruction and fire comes along. I'm expressing myself correctly.
Yeah, I think I understand what you're saying. Right, so, so... it's almost as if that what the Gemara is trying to convey is that Rabbi Eliezer, he didn't mean to cause this destruction.
Yeah.
He had a natural human response, which was he felt terrible. He started crying. And those tears themselves, their power of the tefillah of a great rabbi who isn't even saying that he wants to get revenge, but it's just sort of the natural human response that he had, that in and of itself is what was able to create such damage in the world. And
at all costs, we must stay together.
100%. 100%. And the Gemara then says, finally, and even Rabbi Gamliel, the Nasi of the Sanhedrin at Yavne, the head of the sages who were responsible for the decision to ostracize Rabbi Eliezer, was coming on a boat at the time, and a large wave swelled over him and threatened to drown him, right? So Rabbi Eliezer, again, it was able to invoke this power in the world, and so the main rabbi who was responsible for doing this, he was going to be killed. And Rabbi Gamliel said, it seems to me that this is only for the sake of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, as God punishes those who mistreat others. So amazingly, Rabbi Gamliel, he wasn't taking back what he had said. He still agreed this was the right decision, but he sort of knew that this was just a natural ramification of the actions that he had to go ahead and do. And so what happened? Rabbi Gamliel stood on his feet and said, Master of the universe, it is revealed and known before you that neither was it for my honor that I acted when ostracizing him, nor was it for the honor of the house of my father that I acted. Rather, it was for your honor, so that disputes will not proliferate in Israel, and in response, the sea calmed from its raging. right? So this magnificent event happens that Rabbi Gamliel is at risk of being killed when he's at sea because of how Rabbi Eliezer is reacting, and Rabbi Gamliel himself had to then put in a word with the man on top and basically express that, you know, that this wasn't for me. I didn't do this because I wanted to be proved right. I did it because I was trying to help the Jewish people move forward. And the only way that they can move forward is by not having a dispute at all the way at the top, right? If you have a hung jury, if you have a Supreme Court with only 8 justices and it's a 50-50 decision, then the country has no way to move forward from that. You need to have a majority ruling. And so once Rabbi Gamliel said that, that was enough for Hashem's anger in response to Rabbi Eliezer's anger to sort of be quelled a little bit, and that's why he was able to be saved ultimately. Okay. So I'm trying to think if we want to read a little more. We'll stop here. So I'm curious for some impressions from the Gemara. What do we think about this story overall? Does it bother us? Does it? Do we feel like?
Enlightening.
Sorry.
Change my thinking. It's enlightening.
Okay, that's the goal. but explain. How was it enlightening?
It's enlightening in that at first blush, or first reading, you're confused and you're angry. And yet by the time we get to that which we were discussing in the past half hour, we realize how these sages, these rabbis, the Gemara, knit together my initial response to the second part, and I have a whole new, you know, insight into what's going on. And I saw there's a certain calm about this, that there's an adherence to the law. And what, you know, the overarching thing is, we as a nation, we're held together and we will be able to move forward. And that's essentially it. But it's very hard to discern what I just said from the first reading.
Right.
You know. You feel that, yeah. So they fill you with anger initially. They know what they're doing. This is interesting. They know what they're doing. Myself and what they do is, by couching their terms, manipulating texts, it's a beautiful composition. And I walk away feeling the total reverse of what I did before.
Yeah, 100%. You said it really well. And it really, what the rabbis are trying to accomplish in this story is teach us foundational lessons with how they approached the law, and therefore how it continues to impact us even to this very day. And what the rabbis are teaching us, number one, is that the majority is always correct. They're teaching us that even though the majority is always correct, if you do have an opposition to that, that oppositional voice should be voiced. It should not be silenced until it gets to the point where each side presented its own opinion. And ultimately, the minority does have to accept the majority in order for the halachic system to be able to function properly. Right. And in many ways, this is not really how the halachic world works nowadays, just because of the last 1500 years, how they have unfolded in Jewish history. So you have so many different rabbinic opinions and so many different perspectives, and there has been a decentralization of halacha. Right back in the day, there was a top, and if the top ruled something, that's how it was. Nowadays, there's so many different tops, and so a lot of different rabbis say different things. But even so, it's worthwhile to note that even within the sub-communities that we have, there is a very clear hierarchy. There is a very clear Gadol Hador. There's a very clear rabbi for this community and for that community. And the idea is from this Gemara is that we should do our best to continue to respect that type of authority and trust in that type of authority. Ultimately, what the rabbis really wanted to convey to the nation is that even if there is a disagreement, you have to know that you could always trust the rabbis, because the rabbis in their hearts really do have what's best in mind for the Jewish people. You could not always agree. You cannot always see eye to eye, but you have to trust in the rabbis. And this is probably one of the most important stories in terms of being able to have what we call an amunas chachamim, faith in our rabbis. That certainly nowadays it's as difficult as ever sometimes to fully have faith in our rabbis, but it's important to do so. And, you know, we all are aware of enough scandals out there of this rabbi did this terrible thing and that rabbi did that terrible thing, but to ultimately realize that we do have this faith in the system that's not perfect, but it is the system that we have, is I think really the foundational message that the rabbis are trying to get at. And with that, so I think we'll stop here for the day, and God willing, next week we'll take a look at another similar type of story that hopefully will have as much of a life-changing impact on Walter as this one did. But again, if anyone has any additional feedback, if we do like the style, don't like the style, let me know. But otherwise, we'll plan to keep going. And
is it disheartening to think that the rabbis we look up to and respect could do something so terrible that they would ostracize it? That's very unsettling in my mind.
Well, it's a really important point. How could the rabbis have done this? And I think that really what the point of the conclusion of the Gemara over here is that the head of these Chachamim, Rabban Gamliel, at the helm of it all, was saying that it wasn't for his own honor, right? It was for what he believed was the right thing to be done in terms of service of Hashem. And so with that in mind, it's not coming from his ego. It's not coming because he is trying to hurt another person because he tried to hurt him. It's specifically because he's doing this all what we call the Shem Shemayim. And when you do things, at least with that in mind, it doesn't always soften the punch really, but it does explain or justify it in some ways. And so is it a harsh move? Yeah. Are sometimes harsh moves necessary when you have a complex leadership structure and you need to help perpetuate and continue society to run? Yeah. Are we happy that we don't have to make these decisions? Absolutely. And that's really what it comes down to. And it's to be able to have faith in these types of these rabbis, the greatest of the great, to be able to do the right thing and use their power properly and not abuse it, which is obviously something that we become more and more weary of nowadays. It's certainly complex. It certainly should rub you the wrong way. But ultimately, the takeaway of the Gemara is that we have to recognize and respect that sometimes this is how the system works, and we have to continue to try to make the system as best and as good as it can be. But when push comes to shove in a situation like this, it is necessary. And it's also, I'll say one more point about it, it's worthwhile noting that it's not like, God forbid, the rabbis hated Rabbi Eliezer. It was all understood in the context of these were conversations l'shem shamayim. This is all to serve God properly. And so, again, not a perfect answer, not a perfect explanation, but that's what I would say to hopefully quell a little bit some of the concerns here.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
I have homework for you.
Okay, I love homework.
Yes. No, I'm very serious. I want you to appear before the Supreme Court of the United States. Bring this folio up to the court and tell them that the rabbis, under no circumstances, would deal or countenance the fact that one of their rabbis is receiving a stream, a pipeline of millions of dollars from Harlan Crow to Justice Thomas. That you would tell them that the rabbis, the ancient Hebrews, would throw this person out of the court to do exactly what you said, which is to keep the faith into the court and hold things together. And I suggest you appear there Friday. I'm dead serious. I need to know this.
Okay, Walter, if you set up the appointment.
I have something to say.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Okay, I have something to say about this, what we learned today. Because what the rabbis then did, and when I thought about it, you know, in terms of what Rabbi Winston said, I think, though, that leads to things that we have today where one group of Jews don't recognize another group of Jews as Jewish, or say, oh, this group of Jews are not Orthodox. And I think it leads to conflict and tension in the Jewish community. And I would like to see more openness in the Jewish community. I feel that it is important for us to reach out to Jews, and I am actually proud to say that I interact with, you know, Jews in variety of communities, variety of Orthodox communities, and that gives me a wide range of experiences and you know, ways of looking at things and ways to grow. You know, that if you are in one mindset, you don't experience those ways of growing necessarily. So,
and you're not supposed to judge, Helen. You're not supposed to judge.
And that's the thing I'm saying, you know.
That's what I'm saying, too.
Because if you're more open and you don't say, oh, you know, and you, you know, then, you know, we grow and we have more experiences and we don't judge. Yeah, so.
Yeah, I mean, so 100% hear where you're coming from, Helen. And again, this is not how the Jewish world works nowadays. It's not supposed to be how it works nowadays.
I say it still works that way.
No, but what I'm saying is that as far as the Gemara is concerned, the Gemara had a centralized form of Judaism. We do not have a centralized form of Judaism. That is how things unfolded. Now, that said, it is worthwhile saying that while we believe in unity, there is certainly something important about standing up for what you believe in, right? So in other words, we absolutely accept and love every single Jew. I'll speak personally. I very much so love and accept every single Jew. That doesn't mean that I don't have my own halachic opinions of how to do things. And when it comes to one sect of Judaism versus another sect of Judaism, so obviously Orthodox Judaism, at least I as an Orthodox rabbi, I think that I'm correct. I don't hate the other Jews because they've chosen another lifestyle, but I do think that my opinion is correct. I feel very thankful that I'm not in a position, and I have no desire to be in a position all the way at the top to have to condemn anyone, because it's not my comfort zone. But these individuals, in a centralized form of Jewish government, in a sense, they felt they needed to do it. And we don't even understand what that would be like nowadays, because it would be like imagining that the state of Israel functioned with a uniform halachic perspective, which they don't even have that. They have two chief rabbis for Sephardim and Ashkenazim because they can't figure it out, right? So forget about having one, and not everyone accepts those rabbis. So it's almost impossible really to wrap our heads around what this type of structure looked like, but at the end of the day, I think it's worthwhile noting that we do have an openness, but we do also have our principled opinions. And that doesn't have to mean you hate someone else. And that's not what the Gemara was saying either. It doesn't say they hated him. It just says that they had to make it clear to everyone else what halachic opinion they followed. Yes? June, is that raising a hand or is that saying goodbye or rock on?
That's saying I love you.
And that's saying I
miss you and love you. I don't know how to do miss you.
Morris. All right, everyone. But
I had Purim in Florida, so that was good.
How was Purim in Florida? Hot.
Great. We made a homontage. It was fun.
Amazing.
I've not